This is the Friday Show on KLCC. I'm Rachel McDonald. Lane County Senior Public Health Officer Dr. Patrick Ludke is here. Hi, Dr. Ludke.
Hello, Rachel. Glad to be here.
Thanks so much. We've had some good news and not so good news this week. The Oregon Health Authority has approved more groups to be eligible to receive the COVID-19 vaccine, including frontline workers, people in multi-generational households, and those aged 16 to 44 with pre-existing conditions. And today the governor extended that eligibility to the families of frontline workers as well. But she also warned of a fourth surge of COVID-19 cases. So can you give us an update on how things are going in Lane County?
Yeah, absolutely happy to do so. And that is exactly right, that we really had that dearth of cases for a few weeks. Things just plummeted, which was really welcome. But over the last 10 days or so, we've seen an uptick. And we were able to get out of the extreme risk category and high risk all the way down to low risk. But if we stay on the current rate that we're at over the last 10 days, we'll probably be back up to moderate risk, you know, 10 days from now. And part of that was expected, right? We know that some kids are getting back to school, which means teachers and support staff are getting back to school as well, so there's more exposures. But also I think people are letting their guard down a bit, and we know the virus is still out there. We still have a huge percentage of our population that is not immune, so we have to continue to be careful.
And as you mentioned, kids are going back to school for in-person learning, and we heard this week that some school-age kids have tested positive for COVID-19. Can you explain that, and how much of a concern is it as more students are going back to school?
Well, it is a bit of a concern, and it's interesting that as we do these contact tracings and these case investigations, we learn more about what the exposure environment was. A fair number of these cases from younger persons are coming linked to school one way or another, but perhaps about half of them are linked to other events outside of school, and those are people getting together for whatever reason, the beautiful weather, family reunions, etc., and we're finding outbreaks in those spaces too. And one in particular, I of course can't give any specifics, but it was an event to honor some elderly people in several families and ended up being an outbreak. And hopefully those elderly persons, grandmas and grandpas, were all vaccinated. I don't know if they were yet. Our investigation isn't complete. But even if it wasn't, no vaccine is perfect. Those people are still at risk. So we just have to be careful because the virus is still out there.
And with school, in-person school resuming, is there increased testing in place for students, teachers, and staff?
Well, so our state has, the short answer is yes. Our state has this RSSL program, Ready School Safe Learners is what that stands for. And there's a, gosh, it must be 50-plus pages. I haven't read it for a while, but there's three sections on there that deal with the public health and health-related functions of how to keep students, staff, and faculty safe. And part of that means testing. And they have to have a testing program, and those test results have to be reported to public health. And of benefit, really, is that we have these rapid antigen tests that are free. We are sharing them readily with schools. They are using those tests. So, yes, testing, as the students come in, teachers come in, testing increases, and we get more test results.
So let's talk a little bit about long haulers, people who've gotten COVID-19 and continue to have symptoms months later, even as much as a year later. How is public health following them, and why is this an issue for some people?
You know, this really reminds me of some other novel infections that we knew very little about initially, and then over time we learned, gosh, they cause more problems than we thought at first. So the one that really pops to my mind over the last few months, partly because I lived it as a public health professional, was West Nile virus. And whoever would have thought that something called West Nile virus would end up in North America? I mean, gosh, the Nile River is in eastern Africa, a long ways away, but it showed up on our continent in 1999, spread across the country, going from New York City, where it showed up first, all the way to the West Coast within just a few years. And some people got really sick, but most people didn't. And early on, I remember I was at a different health department. I was working in Utah then. And when it hit Utah in 2003, 2004, we were talking about one of these syndromes, and it's West Nile fever, and most people have like a flu type of illness, and they all get better. And we heard very quickly, within probably a month, hey, I had West Nile fever, and it wasn't like the flu. I've had the flu before. And I think there's a parallel here, even though it's a completely different virus, that, you know, most people who get COVID are either mildly symptomatic or asymptomatic, about 80% of them, and they probably never even get tested because it's so mild. But some people have a more severe condition, and while hopefully the vast majority of them recover, not everybody does. Some people get these long-haul symptoms, and the most common ones are fatigue, shortness of breath, cough, joint pain, chest pain. Those are the most common symptoms. But some people have even more serious symptoms. You know, they have cardiac muscle injury and kidney injury and some more serious lung injury, and we don't fully understand it. One aspect of it looks fairly similar to this condition that has various names, which usually tells you we know less about it than we would like to. Dysautonomia or orthostatic tachycardia syndrome, those are some of the names. Basically, you have this autonomic nervous system, this automatic nervous system that you don't control. It controls your sweating. It controls your heart rate. It's just different than the system that you control that allows you to move your legs or move your arms. That's the somatic system. So somehow COVID affects that part of the autonomic nervous system. And if you are no longer able to control your heart rate, or your heart rate goes crazy when it shouldn't be, you're not running away from a tiger, it doesn't need to go up to 200 beats a minute, or if you can't control your blood pressure, then you don't get enough blood to your head, and you get this kind of brain fog symptom that some people with so-called long COVID have, that part of the system, the nervous system, seems to be affected. But we don't fully understand it all, Rachel, and as you can probably tell, we could talk about this for a long time.
Okay, well, I'm going to stick with the topic because we do have a couple listener questions. I'm going to go to one right now.
Hi, my name is Dave and Eugene, and have a question on COVID. For the after vaccination, can you still get mild symptoms or be asymptomatic with COVID-19? And can you still be susceptible to the long haulers disease? I have not heard anything on the local or national news about that question.
Good timing on that question. So we have been wondering for some time the overall effectiveness of these vaccines. After you get vaccinated, can you still get an infection? And part of the reason that we wondered is when these companies submitted their data to the FDA, they submitted data showing that the vaccines prevented COVID disease. It didn't show data that it prevented COVID infection. We just had to get these vaccines to market. They had to be safe. And the biggest effect we wanted was to make sure people didn't get severe disease and ended up being hospitalized. And they, of course, showed good data. Pfizer was 95% effective at preventing that, and Moderna was 94.1%. Very good data. But just this week, on Monday, a big population-wide study, thousands of people in the healthcare space, these are healthcare workers who were fully vaccinated, but they were also tested for COVID every week with the fancy molecular PCR tests. And turns out that in the real world, so not in study conditions, not in these phase three research trials where everything is trying to be perfect, but in the real world, these vaccines were 90% effective at preventing infection. So not just COVID disease, actually getting sick, but preventing infection. So I think that's the answer to the gentleman's first question. They're pretty darn good. Don't you wish our flu vaccines were 90% effective? They're not. They never have been. We sure wish they were. So that's a good thing. On the long COVID side, there are some data, a little bit of data out there, that some people with long COVID get better after vaccination. We don't fully understand it. If you think of long COVID as this immunological driving, ongoing, misery, where your immune system is charged up and it's playing with your autonomic nervous system, it's playing with your thoughts and concentration. Well, if you do something to drive the immune system, like you get vaccinated, it's going to do something to that long-haul COVID response. But we don't have enough data to say everybody with long-haul COVID should go out and get vaccinated or revaccinated. We just don't know. We also don't know if people who have received the vaccine are at higher risk of long COVID, because we've only been vaccinating since mid-December. There was plenty of long COVID long before the vaccines came around. So we're not linking those, because there was long COVID before we had vaccines. So more data to answer his second question is needed.
So if someone does have long COVID, would you encourage them to get a vaccination, or do you think it's more of a case-by-case kind of thing?
Yeah, it's tough. I think that the best thing to do is for them to talk with their primary care provider, the person that knows them best, and do a full physical exam, because, again, long COVID is a plethora of different types of symptoms. A fair number of people have this dysregulation of the nervous system, but not everybody. Some people have these other symptoms that are predominantly sort of the kidney being affected, or predominantly the psychiatric, you know, they just can't concentrate and their thoughts are just crazy. You need to be evaluated by somebody who knows you best. But certainly some people are getting better after vaccine, so it should be part of the list of options.
So is Lane County getting enough vaccine doses right now? We've heard that Oregon has already, just today I heard that the state is complaining that it's not getting as much as it should.
Yeah, well, that's a pointed question. I would like to have more vaccine, but like we heard this week, you know, there was a spoiled batch at the Johnson & Johnson factory in Baltimore, and a few million doses were lost. Gosh, that would have been nice to have had that many more doses for the entire country, which would have meant certainly more for Oregon. So I guess the phrase, you know, you can't get blood out of a turnip is sort of apropos here, because there's only so much vaccine out there. The other part of this, of course, is the state of Oregon, or is Lane County, as one of our 36 counties, getting its share? The last few weeks, we've been getting a bit over 9% of the total state allocation, and our population is a bit over 9% of the entire state population. So, you know, there's some equity there, but overall, we just need more vaccine.
All right. Well, here's an email from Norma, and this has quite a few questions in it, so hopefully we can keep track. She says, when a person is fully vaccinated, exactly what protection are they getting? Does a vaccinated person not get COVID, or does a vaccinated person get COVID but not a serious case? In other words, does 90% protection mean 9 out of 10 people won't get COVID?
Yes. So I think I can answer that.
Good.
So with that recent study in healthcare workers, real-world functioning, people who are exposed on the job, most of them wearing masks, of course, and practicing good infection control, but no infection control is perfect. And, of course, they have a home life, too, and maybe they were exposed outside of work. Hopefully they're only working 8 hours a day, and so 16 hours a day they're doing something else. So with that real-world experience, people who were vaccinated with the two vaccines that were studied, Pfizer and Moderna, they had 90% effectiveness at preventing COVID infection. And that was proven because they were tested every single week with the PCR test. So that's really, you know, that's wonderful news to hear. Because, again, we thought it was just preventing COVID disease. You could still be infected. So to the emailer's question, the first question, yes, we think that in the real world, these vaccines will be 90% effective at preventing COVID infection. That's not 100%, but it's pretty darn good. And then after you get the vaccine, can you still get COVID? Well, yeah, 10% of people can. And we don't know how long the antibody levels will be high enough to prevent reinfection. We just had another study showing that we have, I think it's 7 months of data now, showing that the antibody levels are still high enough and of the right kind, the so-called neutralizing antibodies, to prevent the infection. But will it be 2 years, 5 years? We don't know. That data will only come over time.
This is the Friday Show on KLCC. I'm Rachel McDonald. We're with Lane County Public Health's Dr. Patrick Ludke. And here's a question regarding mass vax sites.
My name is Roxy. I am not an anti-vaxxer, exclamation point. However, I am one of those people who is allergic to everything and have had previous very bad, severe reactions. I have been through anaphylaxis twice from the flu vaccine. I had a severe reaction, but not to the level of anaphylaxis from the tetanus booster that I got. And I'm very concerned about going through a mass vaccination site, because what happens if I start to go into anaphylaxis? Are those people prepared to deal with a severe, fairly immediate adverse reaction?
Gosh, that's a really good question. It's almost a poster for what we want to not happen at our mass vac sites. So if someone has a history, like Roxy just shared, probably it's not the best place to get a vaccine, a mass vaccination site out in a parking lot somewhere. It would be better for her to go to her regular primary care provider, or one of the other facilities. Peace Health is doing it, McKenzie is doing it, you know, next to a hospital, where oxygen is hardwired into the walls and those sort of things. We do have emergency response at all of our mass vax events. We have adrenaline, you know, the shot that you give when somebody has an anaphylactic reaction. We have portable oxygen. We have some of the other medications that you use when somebody's having anaphylactic reaction. And then, of course, we get them in an ambulance and get them off to definitive care quickly. But if somebody has a history of having had anaphylaxis before, don't take the risk of having it done out in a parking lot. Please schedule it how you regularly schedule your flu shot every year. She said she had anaphylaxis twice. She probably got that at a doctor's office. And I really appreciate her asking that question, because we don't want people to show up to our facilities with a history like that. It's just not the right place for them.
Well, here's a question we got via email. This is from Michael, who wants to know, is someone who's been given both vaccination shots at risk of contracting one of the COVID-19 variants, and could contracting a variant of the virus be fatal?
So we're getting more and more data every week, it seems, on how good or what the risks are for these vaccines. And for Pfizer this week, there was another study released for the Pfizer vaccine showing that it works quite well with the three major variants that are out there now. The 117 variant from the United Kingdom, the P1, so-called P1 variant from Brazil, and then the South African variants. And yes, it works less well, but it still has the level of antibodies that provide protection. So that's really heartening. So we have not yet seen a variant out there, despite a lot of surveillance looking for variants, that has completely mutated out of either use from our existing vaccines or vaccines that are coming on the market here in the next couple months. Could it happen? Absolutely. These viruses, they mutate a lot. But that's why we do ongoing surveillance, to make sure we know what's out there circulating, so we can be prepared.
Okay. Well, I mentioned that we wanted to kind of talk about the future, and to start with, we're going to ask you about live events. This is a question we got from one of our listeners.
Hi, my name is Ron, and I'm a musician here in Eugene, and for years I've supplemented my income performing at local clubs. I'm just wondering what's your best guess as to how long before I can expect to return to the stage? Are we talking weeks or months?
Oh, that's a really good question. And the challenge with answering that question is there are at least two main parts to the answer. The first is, when is it clinically safe, population health safe to do so? And the second is, when is that entity, that agency, that the jazz station or the vets club or these other live music venues, when do they feel like they can open up and not lose money? And, of course, public health is not going to make that decision. If one of these live music venues decides to open up, it has to have a business sense. It can't just be we're going to do one show every so often and pay people, because that's not a winning financial proposition. So on the clinical side, which I can speak to, if we stay at the lower risk level, and again, we're at a bit of a risk of not doing so given the uptick in cases recently, some of these indoor events could open with 25 to 50% occupancy right now. And if we move to moderate level of risk, these indoor events could be up to 100 people indoors. And I've been to the jazz station many times, wonderful place, doesn't hold 100 people. So they would have to open with the appropriate infection control, but it has to be financially viable for them to do so. And that's a tough decision. So long story short, I think a betting person would absolutely say we're going to have significant indoor events by the summertime. And a lot depends on the month of April. I know listeners have been hearing me talk about April for a long time. this is really kind of the inflection month. As we've looked out at the amount of immunity growing from infected people, the amount of immunity growing from the number of vaccinated people, and then the change in weather and more people outdoors not breathing the same air, if we can get through April with no huge drop in vaccination, no massive outbreaks, I think we're going to have a pretty good summer. Now, the other outlying risk, of course, is variants, and we got to be careful with those. But I would say to the musicians, look to the mid-summertime.
And, yeah, as we are looking ahead to the summer, anything else you want to say just about how you're seeing and why April is so important to looking ahead to the summer?
Yeah, and again, you know, part of it, too, is not just the weather and the growing immunity. It's also our better understanding of how these vaccines are working out in the real world, and then the pipeline of vaccines that we've been promised from our federal colleagues that are coming. So we're going to get the Novavax vaccine. We're going to get more Johnson & Johnson vaccine. We're going to get vaccine for adolescents probably in midsummer. Right now we only have vaccine from age 16 and up. And with the large increase in access to these vaccines, the horizon looks, you know, a lot brighter. It looks a lot better.
Well, that's a good note to end on.
I think it is. You know, I guess maybe I would add one more thing quickly. We are now up to almost at 30% of adults fully vaccinated in this county. That is wonderful. And, you know, we want to get higher than that, of course. But that is a really impressive way forward. And this weekend, we're going to have another clinic at the Lane Events Center and at Austin Stadium where we're going to try to vaccinate another 11,000 people. So please, those of you who are not yet vaccinated, please sign up to get into that clinic and get into our clinics next week.
And that can be done at the Lane County Public Health website. And you can also call 541-682-1380.
You got it.
Thank you so much, Dr. Ledke.
Happy to join you, Rachel, as always.
Dr. Patrick Ledke is Senior Public Health Officer with Lane County. You can send your questions for next week's Friday show to news@klcc.org as an email or voicemail, and you can leave us a voicemail at 503-877-3198. We had production help from Angela Kellner. I'm Rachel McDonald. Enjoy your weekend.